Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Hello, I'm Tom Weber. Thanks for listening to NPR News here on the radio or online or on our podcast. There has been a lot of news to follow up on this week, including the Supreme Court's decision to hear the travel ban case. We heard in the newscast there that that will partially take effect this evening. Carrie talked about that on this show on Tuesday. Then we had the delay in the Senate on the health care bill that would affect everyone listening, regardless of how you get your insurance. Carrie talked about that yesterday. We did not want to let this week end, though, without a check-in on another important story, Syria. There were warnings this week from the Trump administration about Syria and chemical weapons. How does that play into the six-year civil war there? Efforts to combat ISIS and efforts to find some way to end the fighting. That's what we're going to talk about this hour. And we invite your calls. If you've been listening to the Syria news this week, this month, what is still resting with you as a major question for how this is panning out and playing out and how it should, give us a call. 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. You can tweet me at WeberTom1. And please don't call or text if you're driving. My guest this hour, Nader Hashimi, is director of the Center of Middle East Studies at the University of Denver, author of Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. Nader, thanks so much for your time. It's good to talk to you.
Thanks for the invite.
And Kathy Gilsonen is with me for the first part of the show, global editor for The Atlantic. Kathy, I appreciate your time as well.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
I'm going to ask both of you, Nader, I'll start with you. Are we at war right now with Syria?
Well, we're partially at war. It depends on what you mean by Syria. If you mean by Syria the regime of Bashar al-Assad, then no, I would say we are not at war with that part of Syria. But we're certainly at war with what's happening in the eastern part of Syria, the part of territory that the Islamic State controls. And so we're deeply involved in that part of Syria. What comes after the defeat of the Islamic State in terms of future U.S. policy is really the big question to which no one really has a clear answer.
Kathy, what would you add to that?
I think the question of whether we're at war with Syria, as Nader points out, is distinct from the question of whether we're at war in Syria. We've certainly been bombing the country itself for several years. And while U.S. officials insist that we don't seek an escalation with the Assad regime, we don't seek to open up another front in this war, and indeed, you know, the president was elected at least partly on promises to keep American troops out of the Middle East, you have seen what some view as an escalation in recent days, certainly the willingness to push back against Assad and allied forces, both in April following Assad's use of chemical weapons against the civilian population, and more recently in providing air support for U.S.-trained Arab fighters in the south of the country.
Is there any way, Kathy, to judge or know, you know, one of the commentaries or questions I've seen is, especially on this question of whether we're at war specifically with the Assad regime, if not technically or legally at war, are we accidentally sliding into it through some of the actions? What would you say on that?
This is certainly a question and concern that is alive and well in D.C. I think the people that are, you know, the government officials will say, no, these moves against, with the exception of the punishing strike for chemical weapons use, these recent moves against the Syrian regime and its allies, I believe there have been four such confrontations in the past recent weeks, have been portrayed as basic force protection measures, right? We've got our guys there. They're threatening our guys. This is pure self-defense. This is not, we're able to contain this. I think the concern there is that, you know, Donald Trump has stated that he's delegating a lot of these decisions to the military. There has not been, to my knowledge, a policy decision on this. And so the concern is that, you know, ground level commanders are taking us into war potentially without, you know, without involvement from policymakers back in Washington. And I think that there is a real danger there.
We're taking your questions as well as we talk to Kathy Gilsonen from The Atlantic and Nader Hashimi from the University of Denver, director of the Center for Middle East Studies. They are 1-800-242-2828. And, you know, there seems to be, Nader, and I really appreciate the distinction you made, fighting ISIS, trying to defeat ISIS, Islamic State, versus trying to defeat Assad, try to get rid of the Assad regime. Can we defeat ISIS and stay out of the civil war? Can we do both?
And did you say dig out of the civil war?
Stay out of the civil war.
Stay out of the civil war.
Yeah.
Well, I think that very much has been the plan and the hope of both the Obama administration's policy towards Syria, and what we're hearing also from the Trump administration and their plan for Syria. They want to, draw a clear distinction between the two. And the focus has always been on ISIS, getting rid of ISIS, and not getting involved in the other parts of the war in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
I have always argued that I think is a very false distinction. If you know anything about the background to the history of this particular conflict, ISIS in many ways emerges as a result of the internal conflict in Syria. In the early days of the war in Syria in 2011, 2012, there was no ISIS. But as a direct result of the ongoing atrocities and war crimes and the intervention of neighboring states, you have a situation where Salafi jihadism in the region is given a new lease on life. And then that forces the United States and the West to get involved in Syria in ways that really do not want to address the underlying roots of the conflict, but just want to deal with its core symptom, being the emergence of ISIS. And now that it seems like ISIS is on its last legs, certainly in Iraq, but now also in eastern Syria, this is going to force the question, what is the longer-term strategy that the United States and the West has toward the future of Syria? Are we just going to walk away and allow Bashar al-Assad and his Iranian and Russian allies to run the show? Or is there going to be an attempt to try and deal with some of the underlying fundamental issues that produce this conflict from the outset? So I think those are the big questions that remain to be answered.
It's so complicated, Kathy. I mean, I think that storyline that ISIS is largely or arguably almost defeated, it seems, from my sense, that's actually pretty lost in the conversation, that the, quote, fight against ISIS, you could argue, is in its final months, whatever we want to say, final weeks or months. It gets overshadowed by the horrible images we see of the destruction and of the civil war going on in other parts of Syria.
Right. I think in this sense, you know, the solution to the ISIS problem is just, unquestionably, it would be a good thing to defeat ISIS. And but that solution opens the door to all kinds of other problems. And I think Nader is right to point out that it was always, even under the Obama administration, going to be a tricky thing to try to compartmentalize different pieces of this ongoing civil war. And I think in addition to the history that Nader highlighted, I would also point to questions about the future. As you push ISIS out of these territories, somebody's going to have to govern these territories. And in previous years, the U.S. and the Syrian regime have been fighting on basically opposite sides of the country. But now you're seeing sort of the battle space shrinking. And in these territories that used to be governed by ISIS, U.S. allies and Assad's allies are inevitably approaching and bumping up against each other. And it's not clear to me, it hasn't been stated publicly at least, what is the plan for dealing with that. Now, I haven't spoken to Mattis or McMaster personally, so they may have this well under control. But I think it's a really important question that Americans should be talking about and have more information about.
Right, because the word you didn't use in there was Russia. Is that if the battlefield against ISIS shrinks and there are U.S. and Russian warplanes on the quote-unquote ISIS battlefield, a smaller battlefield means the U.S. and Russia, their yep. planes could get tangled more.
Well, and this is part of the complicating. Russia hugely complicates everything, even aside from it's already being a multi-sided civil war. And yes, you know, in some sense, Russia and the United States and the Assad regime are on the same side in the sense that they all want to fight ISIS. On the other hand, though, Russia and the Assad regime portray and argue that U.S.-backed rebels are also terrorists, right? So we're fighting the same people in some places, and fighting against and backing opposite people in different places, and those places are becoming uncomfortably close to one another.
Nader, let's branch that out a little bit as we talk with two guests here about Syria, try to get people caught up on the latest news this week and how it plays out and the 6 years of civil war that we've seen there, hundreds of thousands of people dead, millions of refugees. We're taking your questions as well, 1-800-242-2828. Nader, give us the Cliff's Notes, the 90-second rehash of what Kathy was just talking about. What is going on? Where are the sides? Where are the pieces on the chessboard?
Sure. Well, I mean, the origins of this conflict are absolutely important if you want to understand what's going on. And the conflict in Syria begins in the context of the Arab Spring uprisings in March of 2011, when, for the same reasons that people protested in other Arab countries, they rose and they protested against a 41-year dictatorship. And in those early years of the Syrian uprising, particularly in the first year, the demonstrations were largely peaceful and nonviolent and nonsectarian. But as a result of the brutality of the Assad regime, backed by Russia and Iran, you have a peaceful conflict, you know, gradually becoming militarized and then radicalized as neighboring countries come in, backing different factions. And over the course of the last 6 years, you have, you know, the Assad regime trying to retain power in Damascus, and the war has sort of fluctuated. There has been open acknowledgement by Russia and Iran that the Assad regime was within a couple of weeks of being toppled until, and as a result of a stepped-up Russian and Iranian intervention, they were able to tip the battlefield conditions in the favor of the Assad regime. Support for the rebels has always been a much more confusing picture. There have been numerous, in fact, hundreds of different rebel factions backed by many of the neighboring states. There was a moment in the early years of this war where a more moderate group of rebel groups seemed to have some possibility of challenging the Assad regime. I think those days are long gone, and the remaining rebel groups are largely, deeply socially conservative and radical groups that have a political program that is quite, you know, disconcerting in terms of the future of Syria. So, you know, the prospects for, I think, any sort of positive outcome of this war, I think, is long past. And that's largely as a result of the fact that the international community, led by the United States, right from the beginning, made the calculation that, you know, Syria just doesn't affect our national interests. We don't want to get involved to sort of deal with the underlying roots of this conflict. And so now you have a situation where effectively Russia, Iran, and Assad have, you know, won most of the major battles. The key turning point was last December when the city of Aleppo fell, and most of the rebel groups are now in sort of scattered rural areas. And the Assad regime is looking quite good in terms of their ability to retain control over the country. The big question is really what happens after ISIS is defeated in eastern Syria and who controls the land that ISIS was in possession of. At one time, they controlled about one-third of Syria. Will the Assad regime assert control and take over those lands? Will the United States try to assert itself to make sure that the rebel groups that it's supporting will take over those parts of eastern Syria as a way of sort of leveraging and putting pressure on Assad and his Russian and Iranian allies to foster a deeper settlement Those questions remain to be seen, but everything that I'm hearing from Washington is that I don't think there is an appetite in the Trump administration to invest heavily in dealing with the underlying roots of the conflict. I think they're perfectly happy to see Assad recapture control, and you know what that means for the future of Syria, in my view, is not a very good prognosis, because, you know, to think for a moment that the Assad regime, which is overwhelmingly responsible for the vast majority of the atrocities and the 400,000 people that have been killed, can be a stabilizing force in Syria or in the region is wishful thinking. I think that just sets up a stage for greater conflict and turmoil in the months and years to come.
So, Kathy, off of what Nader just said, clarify a couple things. So, the U.S. is opposed to the Assad regime and favors, or at one point did favor, regime change, but not in a way that it's actually actively working for it. It is supporting rebel groups, but not fighting with them. Stop me if I'm saying anything wrong. And so they would like Assad gone. They don't like the options of who else is out there if Assad were to lose. It looks like Assad is going to win. But then over in eastern Syria, you have ISIS with whatever remaining territory it holds, which is an area where the U.S. and Russia and Assad are actually working together in a contorted way. How did I do?
You did fine. I think, I think the request to clarify what is going on is a bit of a tall order, even in, you know, you have, so starting with the Obama administration, the policy was already pretty confusing. I think, the Obama administration during 2011 saw the fall of Mubarak, saw the Arab Spring happening, and thought, and indeed said, Assad's days are numbered. It looked like it was going to be an easy thing. We're just going to say things about what's right and true in the world, and Assad will eventually go. And so, of course, it turned into a much more protracted thing than anyone was expecting. And then you had, but it still looked as if Assad's days were numbered until the Russia intervention. So then the policy sort of shifted from one that hoped for regime change to one that said, basically, you know, there's got to be a political transition. Ultimately, I believe the verbiage used was that Assad ultimately has to go, but it wasn't going to be sort of, the future of Syria is up to the Syrian people. And so currently under the Trump administration, then it's still the early days of the Trump administration. But at first, officials were arguing, listen, Syria's not really, you had the Secretary of State, you had UN Ambassador Nikki Haley saying, the policy of the United States is not regime change. Within a few days following this chemical weapons attack, you then had both Nikki Haley and Rex Tillerson saying, there's no future in Syria that includes Assad in a position of leadership. However, you're getting all these mixed messages out of the Trump administration. It doesn't seem as if officials are really on the same page as regards what exactly the end state goal is in Syria. And so I think what it settles on, again, is sort of, we're arming anti-Assad rebels. We're hoping that he goes eventually. We're not prepared to intervene in a way to ensure that that happens quickly. And also, we aren't looking for a confrontation with another superpower, which is Russia.
Well, if you're confused, that's what it's supposed to be, because it's a confusing situation, but we're trying to weed through it, and we have two good people here to help us do that. Kathy Gilsonen from The Atlantic, Nader Hashimi from the University of Denver, the Center of Middle East Studies there. And we're taking your questions and calls at 1-800-242-2828. Let's go to John in Stillwater. Hi, John. Go right ahead.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I lived in Damascus in 1961 to 1963. I was a teenager at the time. My father was with the embassy. And in that period of time, we had four semi-violent changes of government. The first one was in 1961. There was the United Arab Republic with Egypt, with Abdel Nasser, and then there was three others. And so my question is this: can a democratically elected fairly nice president really rule in Syria? And do you not need some rather tough individuals? And I'm not trying to justify the all of the carnage that's going on, but the concept that we can change the government, I'm just not sure that that would provide any more security or stability or even maybe less Syrian deaths.
Yeah, John, it's a good question. Nader, what are your thoughts on John's question there?
Yeah, John articulates a common view here in the United States that the solution to the instability in the Middle East is more authoritarian strongmen because democratic options just aren't available. I would argue, in fact, the problem is the reverse. It's precisely because of the persistence of authoritarian strongmen and dictators that we're dealing with many of these problems in the region. One has to also add to that that the, you know, the prospects for democratic development and democratic change, you know, don't emerge overnight. The struggle for democracy is a very long and contested process, as anyone who has an appreciation for history will acknowledge. And so, you know, how you get from a position of an authoritarian political ruler to a stable democracy is a tough and tall order. But to think that, you know, the best way to respond to the problems of the Middle East, Syria or anywhere else, is to just invest more deeply in authoritarian regimes is simply going to add to the instability in the region, perpetuate political turmoil, and really inadvertently help the rise of, you know, radical extremist forces that really benefit from this equation. So I don't think the, you know, the response to Syria or any other part of the Middle East is to sort of say, well, let's just do more of the same, hope that authoritarian dictators, you know, win the battle at the end of the day. I think we have to be thinking in both long-term perspectives and short-term perspectives. In other words, I think the long-term perspective has to include options for, you know, political openings, for democratic change, for giving the young people of the region a sense of hope that there are options that they have that do not demand signing on to these extremist groups if you want to bring about political change. So the premise of the question, which I take as a very serious one, needs to really be investigated and thought of at a deeper level. And I don't think any sort of sensible and reasonable answer should translate into, you know, perpetuating political authoritarianism. Because from my study of the region, that's precisely the problem.
But isn't the vision you just laid out there on the way to slowly get to democracy, isn't that sullied by what we have experienced in Iraq in the last decade?
Oh, I agree. I think the entire invasion and the occupation has been badly mishandled and is part of the problem. But also part of the problem, which is often ignored, is that, you know, Iraq had its own set of deep problems that in many ways are still casting a huge shadow over what's happening today and what has happened over the last, you know, 10 to 15 years as a result of the, you know, brutal political rule of dictators and despots, of which, you know, Saddam Hussein was one of the worst. So, you know, the solution that we hear, and, you know, we even hear it among people who are, I think, are very, you know, thoughtful and noble and decent politicians. Even someone like Bernie Sanders, you know, implicitly sort of suggests that the region was much better under the, you know, the pre-2003 political order. It may have been better for the United States in terms of trying to sort of manage this region, but it certainly wasn't better for the people living under the authoritarian yoke of these dictators and who aspire for what most people in the world aspire for, you know, a life of decency and of democracy. So, you know, how you get from, you know, the current political chaos to somewhere much better in terms of, you know, good governance is a tall political order. These things don't happen overnight. There are long struggles and long processes of political change and huge risks involved. But I don't think the answer is to simply say, well, look, it's just too difficult. We're going to put our hopes and our investments in authoritarian strongmen. That's going to simply, you know, perpetuate and deepen the instability in the region.
Nader Hashimi with me from the University of Denver. He's going to stay with me. Kathy Gilsonen from the Atlantic, global editor for the Atlantic. I know you have to run. I just want to see if you had any final thoughts, especially about what you'll be looking for, what kind of questions you have going forward. What are the kinds of things you'll seek to know where this is going, right? The future is so unknown.
Sure. I'm looking firstly, I think, for just a clear articulation of what the policy is. I don't personally think that that's too much to ask, and I think that given the risks and the stakes involved, and you know, particularly this seeming creeping confrontation with Russia and Iran, I would really like to know what is the game plan for how this all ends once ISIS is gone. The other question I have, I agree with Nader that that you know, supporting authoritarian strongmen is not the road to stability in the region. And I remember Condoleezza Rice saying, you know, in advance of the invasion of Iraq, that you know, for decades we supported authoritarians in the region because we wanted stability, and we got neither freedom nor stability. I do wonder about this short-term question about who facilitates these transitions in the short term, and in particular, if we're expecting America to do it because nobody else can do it, I wonder both about the appetite within the administration for committing enough resources to really make it work, instead of doing half measures that will, you know, potentially bring to power, you know, facilitate the rise to power of elements, you know, of elements in society, maybe extremist elements that aren't good for American interests. And I also wonder what, you know, what the United States electorate appetite is for facilitating these transitions overseas. We see that America has elected a president who wants to concentrate on America, and I do wonder how much you know, how much political will there is, how much anybody here outside of D.C. And the foreign policy community, how much people are really concerned about how people govern themselves in the Middle East.
Well, Kathy, thanks so much for your insight. I know you have to run. I really appreciate it. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Kathy Gilson in from the Atlantic Global Editor there. Nader Hashimi continues with us from the Center of Middle East Studies at the University of Denver. And we're taking your calls and questions as we talk this hour about Syria, getting you caught up on all the latest news and conversation about what is and isn't happening there. 1-800-242-2828. You can tweet me at WeberTom1. And please don't call or text if you're driving. We'll get back to your calls and your comments after a quick check of news with Phil Picardi. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Tom. Reuters is reporting U.S.-backed forces have fully encircled the Islamic State-held city of Raqqa in Syria. That after closing the militants' last way out from the south. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights Monitoring Group says the Syrian Democratic Forces, an alliance of Kurdish and Arab fighters, launched a long-anticipated assault on the ISIS de facto Syrian capital earlier this month. An Iraqi commander says his forces have taken Mosul's landmark El Nuri Mosque compound that was destroyed by the Islamic State group last week. Lieutenant General Abdul Wahab al-Sadi says special forces reached the compound and took control of the surrounding streets this afternoon following a dawn push into the area. The Middle East's biggest airline says its flights to the U.S. are operating as normal as new travel guidelines come into effect for travelers for six nations. Dubai-based Emirates says in response to questions about President Trump's travel ban, it remains guided by the U.S. Customs and Border Protection on this matter. The Vatican spokesman says Pope Francis has appreciated Cardinal George Pell's honesty and commitment during his 3 years working to reform the Vatican's finances. The statement said Pell has openly and repeatedly condemned as immoral and intolerable acts of sexual abuse against minors. It said the Pope granted Pell a leave of absence to defend himself. Pell faces charges in a decades-old sexual abuse case from his home country of Australia. And a jury has found five men guilty of involvement in the murder of Russian opposition leader Boris Nemtsov. Nemtsov, a top opponent of President Vladimir Putin, was shot late at night in 2015 as he was walking across a bridge just outside of the Kremlin. Russian news agencies say a jury at a Moscow court today found the suspected trigger man guilty of murdering Nemtsov. Four others were found guilty of involvement in that shooting. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:35.
Next hour on 1A, more on the travel ban, part of which might go into effect today. Then at 11, exploring trauma in communities of color around events like Philando Castile's death last year, the trial this month, and seeing the dash cam video of the traffic stop. Facing and Addressing Trauma at 11.
Programming is supported by UCARE, offering health coverage where personal service and quality care come together to put members first. Learn more at ucare.org. UCARE, healthcare that starts with you. Programming is supported by Black Coffee and Waffle Bar, now serving homemade specialty waffles all day, and Dogwood Coffee at their newest location at Marshall and Creighton in St. Paul. Locations and more at blackcoffeeandwaffle.com.
Tom Weber on NPR News. We're continuing our conversation on Syria. Nader Hashimi with me, director of the Center of Middle East Studies at the University of Denver. Andrew Tabler now joining me, the Martin Gross Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And I appreciate your time, Andrew. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
I'm going to go right to the phones here. Dale's been waiting in Rochester. I appreciate that, Dale, and I think you have a good question, so go right ahead.
Yes, good morning. My question is, has anybody ever sat down with the Russians and asked them what they would want to keep in Syria in order to get rid of Assad? Basically, yeah. Have we ever spoken to them and asked them what kind of guarantees they want from us or anybody else?
Thanks for the question, Dale. Andrew, I'm going to throw you in the mix. What of Dale's questions here on Russia?
Well, I've had conversations with Russian analysts and some Russian officials. They emphasize and have for a while that President Assad is not that important to them, that they would gladly not cut ties with him, but gladly distance themselves from him in the future. And when it comes to in exchange for what, it gets a little murky. Sometimes it's about the single naval pier that they have on the Syrian coast, which is not very significant and strategically is a part of their presence, but not that vital. They also want to maintain the state, they say, but are unable to really explain how the state differs from President Assad other than some procedural predictions. But they want to maintain the state. They don't want state collapse. But then last but not least are sometimes some conversations that they would like to trade some aspects of a different position in Syria for a different U.S. posture in Ukraine, particularly as regards to the Crimea. Now, whether that's the truth or not,
yeah.
I don't know, but that's what they've conveyed to me.
I mean, it's interesting to me, Nader, that everything Andrew just listed are things that are pretty routine and things you can achieve diplomatically. It also, if Syria is not that important to Russia, why'd they get involved in the first place?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the last point that Andrew mentioned is really the key point here with respect to Russian policy in Syria. My reading of what Russia is doing in Syria really has less to do about the internal politics of Syria and much more to do with Putin and Russia's aspirations on the global stage. And they're simply using the conflict in Syria to send a message to the West that Russia is a global player, that the future of international relations, the rules of the international relations system cannot be written without Russian approval. And they've sort of seized an opportunity to sort of get involved in this particular conflict, hoping that it will elevate Russia's position globally. And I suspect that, you know, if there was a serious plan and program for diplomacy, that Russia would be willing to do precisely what Andrew suggested, you know, back away from its support of Assad in exchange for something that they value much greater in other parts of the world, Ukraine, Crimea, or other areas of global interest.
Let's go to Howard in Maple Grove. Hi, Howard. Your thoughts here today.
I'm very frustrated with the impasse at the UN and the Security Council, that with Russia's veto power, the UN is not able to intervene in this. We have a never again pledge after the Holocaust. I've been to Lebanon twice in February and April working with Syrian refugees. So I see the plight and I see that the U.S. has to go alone to stop another chemical attack.
Yeah. Howard, we lost your signal there for a second, but we picked up most of what you said there. Andrew, we haven't talked about the UN even before you got on the show here today, and what Howard was talking about, a kind of impotency there. What of that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So U.S. and Russia have been at loggerheads for a long time. This, as all of your listeners know, well predated President Trump and is not something new. Doesn't mean the U.S. doesn't diplomatically engage with Russia and sometimes have been able to agree on Security Council resolutions that deal with Syria's chemical weapons, that deal with cross-border aid, and so on. Now, what's happened, though, over the last, I would say, year and a half or so, is that the Russians have become very sensitive as the number, and this gets to your listener's question, as the number of UN-verified chemical weapons strikes in Syria has gone up, which there have been at least three for the regime and one for ISIS, mm-hmm. verified, and there have been others that have been reported. As those have gone, as those have become greater and greater, the Russians have become less and less reticent to work with us on enforcing issues around chemical weapons. So they become less reticent. They talk about it, they're concerned about it, but they don't want to put in place any kind of punishment mechanisms. The reason for that is the Security Council resolutions that deal with chemical weapons with the Russians do have a Chapter 7 component to them. Doesn't mean they're completely Chapter 7. Chapter 7 means that you can use military force in some instances. So they're very reticent to cut that off as the number of incidents has gone up. And that's, I think, contributed to, among other things, a lack of coordination between Russia and the U.S. at the U.N.
So, Nader, what of then this week's warning from the Trump administration that they are planning another chemical attack? And then I'm just going to read some AP copy here today that says Syria's government and Russia are accusing, this is today, they're accusing Washington of concocting a provocation in Syria. They're basically saying that that warning from the White House this week about an imminent chemical attack was bunk and that it has serious ramifications.
Well, you know, that's exactly what they said after the April 4th mm-hmm. chemical weapons attack in, you know, Idlib province that resulted in Trump's, you know, airstrike on the military base, and all of the evidence and all of the independent, you know, investigations into that particular chemical weapons attack have proven that the Trump administration's claim was actually bang on point. There was sarin gas used, and it did kill dozens of people. So I don't take what Russia and Syria is saying on this particular topic now very seriously. Not only that, but there's been a well-established pattern of use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime, and every time that happens, Russia makes the same type of excuses, denying that Syria has used chemical weapons. So, you know, the track record that Putin has on this particular topic is not a very good one. The problem, though, with this conversation is that all this emphasis on sort of chemical weapons use and sort of sending a signal to Assad and Russia ignores the fact that the vast majority of the atrocities and the human rights violations and the 500,000 people that have been killed in Syria over the last 6 years have been killed by conventional weapons. So in the United States, whether it's under Trump or Obama, emphasizes, you know, the question of chemical weapons, that basically sends a message to Assad and to his Iranian and Russian allies. Go ahead and kill as many people as you want in Syria. We're not going to get involved. We don't really care. Just don't use chemical weapons to accomplish that goal.
John is listening here in El Paso, Texas. John, I'm glad you're listening to us in Texas, and I'm glad you called in. Your thoughts here today.
Good morning. I wish we had your weather here instead of 110 degrees that it is. But I'll say a couple of things quickly. I am a person of Jewish faith with deep ties to Syria, particularly Aleppo. We have a lot of family there, and I live in a community that is made up of many, many Syrian, Lebanese, Christians, Muslims, and Jews. And the local consensus is that we should pretty much stay the hell out of Syria, that the current Assad is much less bad, shall we say, than his father, who was pretty much roundly abhorred by all of us, and that the feeling amongst us expatriates is that the United States has really dirty hands and fingers. You know, they've been all over the Middle East going back 50, 60 years, and most of the hegemony has been through military and economic means, and we have shown a real disdain for the free will of the people of those countries. And this has been exemplified by your discussion with the invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan, our overthrow of the democratically elected leader in Iran in the 50s. So there's a tremendous distrust among the local community here of anything that comes out of Washington, particularly Trump, who has expressed such a disdain for the plight of the refugees, as the professor has pointed out, that they are suffering terribly, and some of your callers. But there seems to be a real unwillingness at the top of our leadership to really do more than give lip service.
Yeah.
And I wonder what your guess think about that.
Well, I thank so much for the experience there and the thoughts, John, having family in Aleppo. Andrew, I think John brings up an interesting point, because for all the conversations I've heard about Syria, I don't hear the concept or the phrase, the will of the people. And we were talking earlier about the realistic potential in the short term of a democratic society. But, you know, John was talking about just the people he knows saying, we really wish the U.S. would stay out of it, et cetera, et cetera. Where do those viewpoints and opinions land in this global geopolitical conversation?
Yeah, good question. So a couple of initial thoughts, and these are just, again, my thoughts. You know, the U.S. gets involved in the Middle East for different reasons, it's justified using certain reasons. And I think in the previous war in Iraq, that predated the one that we're there fighting now, it was about promoting democracy. That was the goal. It was, among other things, it had to do with Saddam Hussein, was about promoting democracy. Our involvement in Syria has not been about democracy, and it has not been particularly deep. It is about respecting the will of the people, and I think that is an important part of our policy. But the reason for the pressures to do more in Syria are multifaceted. One is just the level of atrocities that's been committed overwhelmingly by the Assad regime, and the level of displacement. It's just not normal nor safe to have a country in which not only the death toll is so high, but over half the population's outside of their homes and running into neighboring countries where we have U.S. allies. We have an interest in a stable Middle East, always have, always will. Or a more stable Middle East. So the fact is that less and less action in Syria over the course of the Obama administration did not make things better, and instead the conflict got worse. The question now is, with the relatively hands off policy we followed, are there things inside of Syria that the U.S. can do to make its security safer and make the conflict make it safer for Syrians? I would say that given the complexity of it, it's difficult, the level of inaction over the last few years. But there are parts of Syria in which the U.S. can do something with allies. We are already doing it to fight ISIS, but we're going to have to do more of it in smarter ways if we're going to both eliminate extremism and come up with a viable settlement that can benefit all Syrians.
We're
very early in that in the process on that, and I don't have all the answers.
Yeah.
But we have to keep focused on that. This is not about democracy promotion at the moment. It's about multifaceted problems that we're going to have to deal with, and the next administration is going to have to deal with.
We're talking this hour about Syria with Andrew Taylor from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, Nader Hashimi, the director of the Center of Middle East Studies at the University of Denver. Another take on the question we just had there, Nader, from Twitter here. I still don't get why the U.S. is so present on the ground. Where is Europe? Where are Arab nations? Especially when we, the U.S., don't take equivalent refugees.
Well, you know, the United States is still the most influential actor in the international system when it comes to military action. Unless the United States leads, the European countries are very reluctant to go in by themselves. And so that's fundamentally why the United States is, I think, in parts of Syria fighting ISIS, because it views ISIS as a clear and present danger to U.S. national security. So I think that's fundamentally the driving force here. We often hear this argument, you know, where is Europe? You know, the European countries have, you know, gotten comfortable with the United States leading and then they sort of following behind. And I don't think that's going to change anytime soon.
Is it worth or valid to say that Europe maybe isn't having boots on the ground, but they're taking more refugees than we are? I mean, is that part of the conversation?
Well, I think that's very important. You know, I think this is one of the tragedies of the conflict in Syria is that it has produced one of the worst refugee crises, some people say, since World War II, at least in the last 25 years. And for all of this talk about in the United States about, you know, the importance of Syria, the current administration has been, you know, deeply antagonistic toward taking in Syrian refugees. Europe has done much better. I think Canada is really leading the way. And Syria now, you know, despite the arguments that we heard from the Obama administration that this is really a conflict that doesn't affect U.S. national interests, it can be contained, Syria is now a global problem. It's a direct result, I would argue, of the failed U.S. policy under Obama towards Syria, that we got the ISIS crisis. And now the ISIS crisis is a global crisis. We know the attacks in Europe in 2015 in Paris and in Brussels were directly organized and orchestrated from ISIS-controlled territories in Syria. ISIS has inspired hundreds of attacks around the world. And, you know, the problem of Syria is not going to go away. I think it's so central to the politics of the Middle East. And in a globalized world, these destabilizing politics, you know, do have ripple effects. And the tragedy of Syria is that it's not just a Syrian tragedy. It's not just a Middle Eastern tragedy. It is now a global tragedy. The refugee crisis is just one aspect of this tragedy. And, you know, these refugees won't be going home. They can't go home, one, because there's not a lot of home left in Syria to go back to. But plus, as long as the fundamental fact is that as long as the Assad regime remains in power, you know, the 5 million officially UN-registered refugees will not want to go back. And so that just perpetuates this conflict. And it demands, I think, you know, greater attention, leadership, and focus. And the sad tragedy of all of this is that the administration in Washington right now is the least qualified diplomatically, politically, to provide that leadership. And that just compounds the tragedy of Syria.
Andrew Tabler, as we close here in our last 5 minutes or so, I want to come back to something we talked about before you came on the show, that in the near term, and we don't know if that's weeks or months, but in the near term, the land and the geographic area where ISIS is actually controlling in Syria is shrinking. We heard in that newscast about another place there in eastern Syria where forces have surrounded the city and are going in after ISIS. And the big question is, after you defeat ISIS, and at this point it does kind of seem as if that day is coming, then what? Questions like, who controls that land? Is it Assad? Is it the U.S.? Is it a coalition, et cetera, et cetera? None of which have answers. We know that, Andrew. But where are the most important conversations, and where do you think we need to be focusing on in the near term as ISIS apparently comes to an end in Syria?
Yeah, I mean, I like how you left the easiest question to last. I mean, you know, we have to recognize that militarily we are, quote, defeating ISIS, and we're denying them of territory and pushing them out of area. And that's good news. The problem is, are we really wiping out ISIS or are we spreading it out? And that is a very good question. I don't think ISIS and groups like it are going to give up. Ultimately, this comes down to, if it's not about democracy, maybe it's about governance. It's about having people, instead of focusing on and joining extremist groups, it's about focusing on building better lives. And the only way they can do that is through stable political systems and ones that have a reasonable amount of accountability that they can get on with their lives. In Syria, we don't have any of that. We're trying to wipe out a military organization that's held over half of Syrian territory for years, and trying to pacify that area in a way is the next challenge. We can't just simply bomb our way out of these problems. There has to be a political component, and we have to try. Some people say we never get it right, but if we don't try and help our allies, those who who we can help to forge better lives. I think ISIS will come back. It'll come back stronger, and we'll end up at war again in the Middle East.
I remember, Nader, when Iraq was at its height, there were some conversations. They never got very far, but there were some conversations about just the components of Iraq. Remember that Iraq was drawn on a map and a table by white men, you know, after a world war, with no semblance of what was the reality on the ground. And there were some conversations, well, should Iraq really become three countries, the Kurdish part, the Sunni part, and the Shiite part? Is there anything comparable to that? I haven't heard anything. I'm really just going out on a limb here. But is there anything comparable to that in Syria that in any way contributes to an answer here?
Yeah, I mean, this is a popular sort of view that the problem in the Middle East today is these colonial borders that were drawn after World War One, and if we could only perhaps redraw the borders in a different way, then perhaps we could diminish the amount of conflict in the region today. I think that's a complete red herring, and I think it actually does not help us understand what's happening in the Middle East. Fundamentally, the problem in the Middle East and the roots of the instability is not where the borders have been drawn, but what has been happening within those borders by post-colonial elites who've basically ruined their societies. The other added component to this debate is that if you talk to most Iraqis and most Syrians today, overwhelmingly they still want to maintain the existing borders. They're still attached to a Syrian and an Iraqi identity. There are serious debates about perhaps redrawing the internal administrative borders, giving people more control over their lives. Of course, this leaves out the question of the Kurds, who have their own aspirations, legitimate aspirations for self-determination. But the problem that we're dealing with in this part of the world is not fundamentally, I think, as a result of where those borders were drawn. And I don't think we can resolve the contemporary conflict by redrawing those borders and sort of hoping that if we could simply separate, you know, Kurds from Shia and Sunni, then we will, you know, we'll get to a better place. I think the real problem is the question that I think Andrew alluded to, the question of good governance, the question of political representation, the question of giving people hope that they can live perhaps a better life outside of the yoke of these authoritarian strongmen who have been running the region, many of them, not all of them, backed by the United States. And I think that's the fundamental, I think, roots of instability, not really the question of, you know, where the borders were drawn.
Nader Hashimi, director of the Center of Middle East Studies at the University of Denver, also author of Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. Thanks so much for your time this hour. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Andrew Tabler, the Martin Gross Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Andrew, I appreciate your time as well.
My pleasure.
And earlier we heard from Kathy Gilson, and global editor for The Atlantic. More online at nprnews.org.